Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by MUBI, the online streaming cinema. For your free 30-day trial, go to mubi.com/filmstage.
Life was filled with guns and war, and everyone got trampled on the floor. I wish we'd all been ready. Children died, the days grew cold, a piece of bread could buy a bag of gold. I wish we'd all been ready. There's no time to change your mind. The sun has come, you've been left behind.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the movie review podcast for thefilmstage.com. As always, I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me today to talk about Mother, the newest film from Darren Aronofsky, we have Michael Snydell.
Good morning.
We also have Bill Graham.
Woo!
Yeah. And we're here to talk about a movie. A film, a cinematic event, the likes of which we have not and probably will not see for quite some time. Whether that is good or bad,
we should say that we haven't seen or likely won't see based in like 2,000 screens across the U.S. So.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. This is a film
that's widely available.
That should not... We'll talk. I guess when we get into it, we'll talk about kind of the circumstances and what makes this a very unique film experience. And that will be part of it. The release will no doubt be part of it. Anyway, follow us on Twitter at Film Stage Show. Follow us on Facebook. Search for The Film Stage Show. Become a Patreon supporting member by going to patreon.com/The Film Stage Show. And with as little as $1 every episode, you can help us to create some excellent, outstanding content known the world over as some of the finest movie cinema discussion that you will ever know. You will get access to a special Slack channel. You will also be put in the running for weekly raffles. This week, we have a giveaway of a DVD that is Beatrice at Dinner. So, if you would like to be entered in to win that DVD, all you gotta do is become a Patreon supporting member by going to patreon.com/thefilmstageshow and signing up to help us out with as little as $1 an episode. If you already are one of our Patreon supporting members, first of all, thank you. And if you would really like Beatrice at Dinner, tweet at us or say something in the Slack channel and we will kind of bump you up into a higher tier of raffle hood. We will put your name in the hat twice so that we don't have a situation where someone gets a DVD or Blu-ray that they don't like. Again, that's patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. In addition, MUBI is helping us to bring you this conversation, and MUBI is the online streaming cinema where you have a constantly rotating selection of 30 films to choose from. Every day they introduce a new film. You have 30 days to watch, and then it disappears into the ether. These films are selected by curators who go out there looking for the best foreign art house, independent, and all-around wonderful cinema for you to see. Bill Graham finally was able to see Mulholland Drive because of MUBI. I had the strange experience of having a very obscure movie that no one ever talks about that I brought up on this podcast appear on MUBI 2 days later. And Michael Snydell last week brought to our attention that there's some John Carpenter flicks coming to MUBI. So this is indeed a great service. And the fact that you can download these movies to go makes it even better. So get your MUBI subscription now. You can get a free 30-day trial by going to mubi.com/filmstage. All right, gentlemen. Before we begin... Any other things to talk about?
No, not right now.
All right. Michael, how you doing?
I'm good.
All right.
No, I'm good.
All right. So, Mother. how best to describe. First of all, movie by Darren Aronofsky, his follow-up to Noah, which was one of the stranger wide-release films to come out in its particular year. Now he has outdone himself. Mother is... it has the trappings of a domestic drama slash psychological horror film. It is about Jennifer Lawrence as a woman who lives with her older poet husband and how their lives are upended when a man in the form of Ed Harris comes to their house thinking that it's a bed and breakfast and her husband just lets him stay. What? This is a movie that should not be in over 2,000 theaters. This is a movie that, when I saw it, I said, that's going to infuriate audiences. And its current F cinema score seems to have proven this.
But to be fair, like, we should specify that cinema score has always been less about a quality of a movie
than
what audiences expect. And so if you go from the marketing of this movie to what you actually see on screen,
yes,
it is misleading to say the least.
Yes.
Or at least present something more straightforward than what
it's interested in. We have brought up CinemaScore on this show before, so I hope that all of our listeners know that the CinemaScore is basically just a general gauging of, did an audience get what they wanted? And in the case of Mother, the answer is resoundingly no. Now, what that has to do with the quality of the movie itself is nothing. For instance, Drive got an incredibly low cinema score. Killing Them Softly got an incredibly low cinema score. And now Mother has joined that special rank of film. Here is the trailer, and then we will talk about it.
We spend all our time here. I want to make a paradise.
She redid all of it. Every last detail. Well, she breathed life back into every room.
Are you happy?
I love you. Please, come in.
Hello.
Hello. He's a stranger. We're just gonna let him sleep in our house. Hello.
Hello.
Did you know he had a wife?
All right. So that is the trailer for Mother. I went into this movie knowing as little as possible about it. So, and I think that that helped. And I think that it's going to be impossible to talk about this film in any way without giving away some of the themes and concepts and ideas and a little bit of the twisting and turning. So we're going to do what we usually do in a situation like this, where we're going to give our one-word answer to the following question, and then we're going to get into our basic review, and then we're going to go full spoilers. So, Bill Graham, one word. Should people go see Mother?
Absolutely.
Michael Snydell?
No.
Brian Rowan? Absolutely.
Okay.
So, so I guess that's all you came here for. If that's all you came here for, you have your answer. Go see Mother or don't see Mother, based on who you trust.
Don't spend money for it.
What the hell does that mean?
It means wait. Wait for what?
Wait
for it to come to some kind of video so you can exit if you'd like.
No, I think that we should be rewarding this kind of risk-taking in film. I think you should go buy 3 tickets, even if it's just you.
I'm somewhere in the middle. Go see this in a theater because it will make you watch it all the way through. So
yeah, actually, that's a very good point, Bill. Don't watch this somewhere where you have the ability to just turn around and leave the room and make a sandwich. So let's talk about it. Stars Jennifer Lawrence, Javier Bardem, Michelle Pfeiffer, and Ed Harris, as well as a couple of others. And it is indeed a movie. So let's start. Let's make this a, what did you call it last week, Bill? A positive sandwich?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so we're going to start with you. Why don't you tell us your broad-based overall thoughts on Mother.
Okay, so I think it's no secret that Aronofsky, well, not even a secret, is very widely known that Aronofsky is playing with the idea that this film is kind of a spiritual sidequel slash, it's inspired heavily by Rosemary's Baby. And even the posters make that absolutely clear. All sorts of different hints in the trailers and things like that. And so what it's kind of promising, if you haven't seen Rosemary's Baby, is basically a slow burn that builds and builds and builds and has a very chaotic and wild ending. This film certainly does that. It delivers on that front, I would say, absolutely. This film is a little bit different from that one as well. It's not quite as simple and straightforward in a lot of ways, and yet in a lot of ways it is. It has very little score. The performances are outstanding. I think Lawrence is given a hell of a day. I remember hearing someone reacting to getting out of this film and saying, you know, does Jennifer Lawrence deserve an Oscar? No, she deserves a spa day, like a really, really, really long spa day. It is incredible to see this. I'm not sure when Lawrence and Aronofsky got together. I'm not sure if it was after this film or during or before. I'm not quite sure of the timeline on that, but certainly any way you slice it, the fact that they are still together after making this film is absolutely insane to me. I don't think we've seen quite a performance from an actress like this in quite some time. Now, whether that's a good thing because it's big and it's wild and it's full of emotion, I'm not sure if that's necessarily the greatest performance I've seen, but it's certainly a hell of a performance. I remember hearing that Dunkirk was one of the loudest films from my friend James, who works at a theater, and he had mentioned how it just really pushes and pushes their system. I would say this film actually goes above and beyond that. It not only has sequences that are extremely loud, they are extremely loud for a long period of time. We're talking about sustained, just, you know, seat rumbling sound for 3-4 minutes straight. It is pretty insane, the soundscape of this film. And that's one of the reasons why I really encourage you to watch it in a theater, beyond just, you know, the inability to kind of pause and take a breath and then come back. The soundscape in this film is absolutely stunning. You hear things off screen and you turn to your right. And of course, Jennifer Lawrence, who is our main protagonist in this film. And the film is, just to make sure audiences are aware, it's almost filmed like they attached a GoPro to like a chest rig. And yet the film, or the perspective, will focus her face.
I want to jump in. Obviously, sure. You were being hyperbolic about that. It is just a handheld camera that tends to be very close.
Yes.
I'm saying that because Aronofsky, that used to be one of his like camera tricks, was to use a chest rig on people, if you remember. Mm-hmm. Pi and Requiem for a Dream. So I just want people to be clear on that point. It is not in this movie.
Yeah, well, and what I was going to say is it appears to be that way until the film will like rotate like 180 or 90 degrees around someone, and all of a sudden you'll get their, you know, side or behind perspective, and all of a sudden you're like, wait, so that wasn't a fixed perspective? Like, that wasn't a camera right attached to their face? Okay, you know, so I imagine the filming of this movie was something to behold as well. The production design is, especially towards the end, is pretty radical. The the amount of stuff that he slams into the last 20 or 30 minutes of this film is pretty stunning. It is also one of the most riveting films I've seen in quite some time. There's a lot of allegories and there's a lot of extrapolation that you can make from this film. And yet, I believe like some of the best films of this nature that you can actually wholly remove that and still experience it and still enjoy it from multiple different aspects. And that's kind of the key here, is that the experience is not tied directly into the interpretation, I believe. So it's brutal. It is absolutely insane. I was riveted from beginning to end. The marketing may be a little bit misleading, but I think this film, it is, my friend Jamie, as we were writing back together, she said, it feels like I just read a novel, like downloaded a novel into my brain. That's kind of the experience of this film, is there's a ton of things going on. There's a lot that happens within this 2-hour framework, and I'd say you certainly get your money's worth, and to absolutely go see it. That's, yeah.
All right. Michael Snydell.
Okay.
It's going to be a good episode, folks. Stay tuned.
I don't want to do this. All right. Here's what I can say for Mother. It goes for it. It really does. The last hour of it, there is indeed stuff that happens. If we weren't reviewing it, I would have walked out. I didn't. I'm gonna say I liked 45 minutes of this movie.
Would that Michelle be Hurst?
Yes, Michelle Pfeiffer is my absolute favorite part of this movie. Mm. Her like aggressively familiar wheedling of Jennifer Lawrence was like, I found the most entertaining thing in this entire movie. I think this is the times I liked this is when it was just becoming like a black relationship drama. A black comedy relationship drama, like in the vein of something like War of the Roses, but also mm-hmm. like in the ways that it leans towards like meditative relationship dramas like Contempt or Belle de Jour. I don't know, guys. I don't have a lot to say about this movie. I was really irritated at it. Once it revealed where it was going, I don't think Jennifer Lawrence is good in the same way that Revenant, just because it puts an actor through the ringer, doesn't make it a good performance. And this, I did indeed want Jennifer Lawrence to get a spa day, but I didn't think she did anything that well. I think
I didn't even mean to interrupt you. I just had a visceral, physical reaction to what you just said.
Cool, so. Cool, Brian. That's going to be the rest of this podcast. So yeah. I've already getting ready. I think that its intimations about theology and philosophy and its allegorical mileage is interesting for a little while, but doesn't remotely take me to the end of the movie. I think this is a fun house with all the cheapness that implies, as in like this is a terrible neighborhood carnival. I don't know, guys. I don't know whether it's just I thought I honestly liked Darren Aronofsky. I rewatched Requiem for a Dream this morning. I don't know why I ever rewatched Requiem for a Dream, but apparently I'm an idiot. And I hated that. So I might just hate Aronofsky's style now as I get older. I have zero tolerance for self-indulgent filmmakers. And I don't.
Can you go into that? What makes you think that he's self-indulgent?
Are you kidding me? Like, even if you like this movie is one giant ego trip, and I don't think that it actually has anything. Guys, I don't want to do this. Like, this is just gonna be like an hour and a half of this. Like, I saw this 3 days ago. I still don't have anything much to say about it.
You told me that you had 5 pages of notes.
I did.
You told me you did.
Have you burned them? What do you mean you did?
They're before the last 45 minutes.
You told me that you about hated things. This movie. Like, tap into that anger.
I hate it because it made me feel nothing. And it made me feel anger. And
how?
I didn't even pay money for this movie and I was angry about it.
I just don't understand how you walk in and have an experience with this film and aren't like
it was just noisy and assaultive and not fun. It was really tedious. I found the whole last 30 minutes that everybody seems to fucking love. I found that so fucking boring. We are going to disagree about this one.
Yeah, I know. Let's I just wanted to tell you.
If you guys want to talk about. I don't have anything to say. You guys can be on point.
Settle down.
No, I am thrilled with where Michael is going right now because I so rarely get to hear what I sound like when I hate a movie. So this is going to be exciting. I'm looking forward to this.
I think
this movie's gross. I think where it ends up is insulting. I think that it takes all of the interesting ideas about cycles of destruction, about creative instincts, about religion, about philosophy, about his interest in mythology, but the fact that he hasn't read the fucking yellow wallpaper. Like, I think all of this is just – it's – just fucking ugh. Like it did nothing for me. It really didn't. I would have watched a home movie with Michelle Pfeiffer. I don't know. Every once in a while it gave me a good image. I guess this is just my La La Land and my Jackie this year. I guess that's just what's happening.
But see, when we hated La La Land, we went into like some detail about
I come here every week to talk about movies. I don't have anything to say about this one. I'm sorry.
The extent of your extremity of your negative reaction would make me think that you do have something to say about it. Like, and I'm not trying to turn this into a review of your reaction because I still have to give my review. But it's you keep saying that, but you very clearly have strong feelings about this film.
This movie just makes me tired. Like, I have nothing.
Well, quit saying that.
Fine. Just like
Captain Fantastic, I'm going to chide you every time you say a one syllable or one word adjective describing this film. Don't say it's interesting because I will slap you across the head.
Well, I've got to search for some new words now, I guess, because yeah, I can't call this movie interesting. So here's I'll do mine and then we can get into this. So yeah, I didn't know what to expect for this film. I assumed it was going to be much more Rosemary's Baby than what actually happened. I will say that this movie, Bill, you brought up loudness. Maybe it was just the theater I was in. I didn't think this movie was that loud. I did, however, think that the sound design was one of the most important elements of the movie. In terms of both creating an atmosphere, but also giving you an insight into the mind and the perception of the main character. I think the fact that you can hear everything in this house that's mm-hmm. happening helps to accentuate the sense of both violation and isolation. Nothing that is in this movie that is out of sight is ever truly out of mind. There is constantly a sonic reminder of what is happening. And that became a very important element, especially early on when the movie is quiet. because you can hear footsteps hammering, and you can hear voices, and you can hear the sound of something falling from, like, a floor and half the house away. And all of that was really necessary to kind of putting you in the headspace of Jennifer Lawrence, who in this movie gives a performance that is nothing, in my mind, like what Leonardo DiCaprio did. Leonardo DiCaprio suffered on a single note for the entire movie. In this film, Jennifer Lawrence has to cycle through the whole spectrum of abuse and anger that a woman in this position would have to take. And when we say abuse, I don't mean just like her husband hits her or something. Quite the opposite. She has been subjugated to the point where every aspect of her being and her action in this house is like a small layer of abuse. She never wears shoes. Every time that someone suggests something happen, she says, "Oh, I'll get it. Oh, don't worry, I'll pick that up." And she goes through that meekness from angelic to imprisoned and back again. And then when the movie hits its a highway, when it really presses down the gas in the end, she goes above and beyond that. And it is a staggering work. Just her performance is a staggering work in this film that works as like an empathetic engine that keeps you invested and drives you through the film, which is important because the film operates on a kind of nightmare dream logic that, absent that kind of human performance to act as the gravity to keep everything down, would be hard to track. Mm-hmm. And the more that happens, and the more that goes on, the more her performance becomes important. Especially because so early on, everyone else strikes such a single note. Ed Harris and Michelle Pfeiffer particularly. But they're and every other guest who shows up, their single-mindedness and their narcissism and the way that they walk all over her is only as effective as her reaction to it. And I think she modulates all of her reactions perfectly. Early on, this is actually sometimes a darkly funny movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that's not getting talked about a lot. But this really is like a sitcom at first, where it's just like, oh, the neighbors are over and they are wildly inappropriate and take too many things and they don't really seem to care about how we're feeling. And when it finally goes crazy, which is not a spoiler to say, I think that the various allegorical threads twine together so tightly that it becomes like a hangman's noose for the audience. And I think that is an impressive feat. I think that the way that this movie could be read any number of ways, and then another person could come up and say, "You thought it was X, I thought it was Y." And those two views can at once exist simultaneously and symbiotically. Because if you view this as an environmental film, and I view it as a religious film, we could paste those two ideas together into a kind of synthesis where perhaps nature becomes God, or, you know, the Virgin Mary becomes the Mother Earth. And it doesn't cheapen one or the other. And the level of specificity coupled with the extreme universal allegorical nature of the story makes it so that it's almost impossible not to do that. Like, even if you take a religious viewpoint, you sort of have to take cues from the artistic viewpoint in order to really make it work. And it's rare that we have a movie that has that kind of layering and weaving of these ideas. And then that's just the intellectual exercise, because on a visceral level, this movie is like shocking and terrifying and and it gets gross and mean and but not mean in the way like a torture porn movie is. Like, it's not mean to the audience. Yeah. It's
mean to Jennifer Lawrence.
It is mean to Jennifer Lawrence. But it's it's such a, and this is what I think I really appreciate about this film, is it's so singular, and it feels at once directed and guided, but it lacks, and this is going to be weird because it's going to make it sound like I'm dissing Christopher Nolan, but we all know I love him, so don't at me. But whereas Christopher Nolan has a very targeted sense of what he's doing and calibrates everything to move towards that single point, Darren Aronofsky in this film has kind of created like a blood-curdling cinematic scream where it's all force and power and feeling and emotion, and he's getting across more than one thing at once. And if you can bear it and you can get through it, I think that this movie gives you a seam of cinematic ore that you can mine and refine into any of a number of totems and artifacts for you to like take from it and learn about and think about. And this is like truly a movie that has the power to instill in you ideas that you may have never thought about, but also challenge ideas that you already have. And I think that no matter what you think about it, you can't really deny that, like, you don't usually get a narrative that is this forceful and this extreme released to this many theaters with this major of a studio behind it. Because this is a Paramount movie. This isn't even, like, Paramount Vantage or something. They put the mountain with the stars in front of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that is bizarre. And I don't know what they were thinking, but I'm certainly glad that they had that momentary lapse in judgment, because I honestly think that the world is richer for having had this film in it.
I agree.
How did I do, Bill?
I agree.
Okay.
Although I will say your introduction that you didn't know what to expect going into this film, I would say is probably wholly false. You knew to expect something insane.
I had a concept of what to expect, but what I expected did not happen, and thus I feel I am in my right to say I didn't know what to expect, because I knew what I thought I expected, but that was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It's like if you're taking a test and get an F. It's like, well, I guess you didn't know what was on that test, did you, sir? So, Michael, do you have any reaction to anything I just said? Do you have any refutation? Any...
What's the opposite of a reaction?
I don't know. Inertia?
Yeah, and I Hey guys, I think we found the movie that broke me.
Well, when you hear someone saying that they took that from this movie, like what does it do to you? Like, how do you reconcile your feelings of non-entity, you know, disinterest with what I've said and what Bill said? Like, what is that? What do you think about us? What do you think about the world?
Do you hate us now?
I think that I'm going to have to hear about this movie for much longer than I want to. I think that the F Cinema score means that people are going to parade this about some magnum opus for years. I think that the context of it being in a studio and its audaciousness, which I say with giant air quotes, means I'm going to hear about it for a long time, and I just never want to talk about it ever again. I would happily.
But why not?
Because I didn't get anything out of it, Brian. I just didn't.
So are you saying that everything that we saw in it is non-existent, or just that?
I just don't care. But I just like, don't, why care.
Don't care. Why don't you care?
I don't know. I don't know. Maybe you could seriously, to pause for a sec, maybe you guys should have someone else on, because I honestly thought I was going to be willing to talk about this, and now we get to this, and I don't have anything to say about this movie. The notes I wrote might as well just be non-existent at this point, because they come before the movie reveals what it is, and
Yeah, but that doesn't discount what that is.
What I'm confused about is how is it how can you not have a feeling about the fact that the movie changed? Like, how can you not? Like, there, you have to have some reaction. Like, I had this reaction once to Camera Person, but that was because I found that movie to be utterly, like, middle of the road. It was neither bad nor good for me. It just was and existed, but I didn't see anything else to talk about.
Sure.
Like, you obviously had a reaction to this movie. You hate it. You want it to go away faster. Like, there should be some level of articulation.
I don't hate it, though. Like, hate it would require too much effort.
So maybe you dismissed it.
I just don't want to talk about it. I don't want to think about it. Like, the more I come in contact with this movie, the more I just my dominant reaction is just sighing, and it's just
I find that like weird and shocking. Like, you obviously had feelings about the movie to begin with, and then you didn't, and now, like, you're faced with two people who had a strong reaction to it. Like, how does that catalyze into something?
You guys just lead the discussion, and I'll just, like, quietly sit here. I'm serious.
I'm gonna see if Jordan can come on, and then we can just, like, bring him on for the spoiler section.
Yeah, maybe you should do that, seriously.
Because you like, I'm trying to, like, draw you out, but you, like, really just seem like you don't want to do this.
Yeah, you've shut down at this point.
Sorry.
That's fine. This hasn't happened. I've never heard of a podcast that midstream had to swap out a guest, so this will be interesting.
Yeah, I don't know.
All right, well, I'm going to stop recording.
See, the thing is, okay. I'll probably end up, like, writing something in 2 weeks or something.
All right, well, we will be looking forward to that. And we're back. For all of you listening at home, that was not scripted or expected or something that we had talked about previously. I knew that Michael didn't like the film, but I thought, much like when I don't like a film, he would be a firebrand speaking truth to power and coming back against us. But apparently, Mother broke him. So in order to fill the hole left by Michael, the dissenting opinion-shaped hole in the podcast, we've called in our benevolent lord and master, Jordan Raup. Jordan, how are you?
Good. I'm glad I can. I'm the go-to for such situations.
Well, after you and I had seen this movie on Tuesday, you said if you need, like, a negative opinion, if you all liked it, you know, tell me and have me on. And when one of us, you know, just broke down and couldn't do it anymore, I thought to myself, well, who better than Jordan Raup? Michael has Slack messaged us and says, maybe I'll go see it again today. I need to figure out where this reaction came from. So if you're listening to this at home, pray for Michael Snydell.
we'll have more information by the time this is out.
Yeah, we will tweet updates about his condition throughout the weekend. We're gonna give Jordan a small amount of time to tell us about his reaction to the film, and then we're gonna hop right into spoilers.
Yeah,
so we can talk about it.
Yeah, well, Brian, as you mentioned that night, I think as soon as I got out, I messaged you guys and just said I cannot wait to hear your discussion. And then message you how I didn't really like the movie. And my opinion has slightly shifted, you know, in the days since seeing it. I think it's one of those movies that's so abrasively unpleasant for literally the entire time you're watching it that which kind of alludes to the F cinema score, which I'm sure you guys might have discussed maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Where it's just, you know, this movie is tailor-made to make you feel uncomfortable the entire time and goes to places that are just absolutely insane, which we'll discuss. But I think when you kind of start to separate the film from literally what's happening on screen versus, you know, a more thematic or, you know, interpretation or allegories, it becomes a little more interesting to discuss. I think that's where, you know, the strength of the film lies, is that kind of aspect of it. I don't think, I guess, my general opinion is that the first hour or so, I really hated. I thought,
wow, that's so different from so many other people.
I know. But I really thought Aronofsky was trying to, you know, do his take on Rosemary's Baby or any other Polanski thriller where, you know, he tries to put us in this psychological headspace. And I think he does it with his touch is so overt and unsubtle, which I think reflecting back on the movie works. But in the moment of the first half, when you're watching it, I just did not buy, you know, anything that was happening, mm-hmm. With the characters or their decisions or, you know, even I think the script kind of feels like, you know, even the script mixed with the sound design feels like it's, you know, a college student's thesis film. Like it just feels like very, just on the nose and just not that interesting, I think. And then finally, when he just kind of goes for broke and just ups the insanity, I was one of the few people in the press screening kind of laughing hysterically. And I don't know if anyone else had that reaction, but, and so it was just, so insane and ridiculous that I kind of couldn't believe what I was seeing and liked it on that level. So yeah, I will say, like, I think The Fountain is kind of a masterpiece, and I've said that since I saw it on opening weekend, when no one else really saw it, and then it just kind of endured, and I've watched it many times since then. And yes, it's a little pretentious in ways, but I think that movie kind of there's a poetic quality to it, and he's kind of digging at similar themes, I think, with that film that works much better, whereas this is just kind of a blunt exercise in pretty much trying to tell the story of the Bible, plus kind of a million other things, which is ambitious in itself. And it's one of those movies that I would see again, now that I know, you know, the finale and what happens, and kind of seeing it in a different context, I do wonder if I would like the first half better. But it's one of those films that, you know, most audiences will reject, which they have, judging not only from the cinema score, from the box office. And, but I do think it is kind of a worthwhile film to discuss and at least see, just because you're not going to see anything else like it this year. And on that level alone, I could recommend it, but, yeah, it is interesting, I guess, how my opinion has shifted a little bit. And I will say it shifted before the F Cinema score came out, because I saw Michael Snydell tweet that that will like be a badge of honor for people in a negative way, he said, and it'll give the film more credence than it maybe should have been given. Whereas I was thinking this before they came out, so I'll just put that on the table.
He truly hates this film. We're going to have like bi-monthly follow-up sessions with him.
Yeah. It's one of those movies I don't like begrudge anyone for hating just because, you know, of what it puts on the table. It is like, there were times in this movie where I was like, this is one of the worst films I've ever seen. Like as I was watching it, like certain scenes. And then by the end, I just kind of let myself go and be like, okay, he's trying something here. And, I guess it's worth
One thing I kind of want to bring up real quick is like how he got this film made. You know, it costs $30 million. I don't think it's going to make back its budget so far. But like Black Swan made a shit ton of money. It was financed for $13 million and made $329 million worldwide. The Wrestler also did fairly well off of $6 million and made $44 million. And then Noah actually did decent with $125 budget and $362 worldwide.
Wow, that is so legitimately shocking to me.
Yeah, I didn't know I didn't know Noah turned a profit at all. Apparently, it was a big hit overseas, not so much here, which doesn't surprise me. But you know, looking at his films, I was like, okay, yeah, why would a studio basically give him carte blanche to make whatever the hell he wanted? And Paramount is the one that financed or produced. Or distributed, I should say, Noah, they weren't involved in any of those other films. So based almost solely on Noah, they gave him the money for this film, which seems kind of insane. Well,
I would also say, I mean, I'm sure he sold it as, you know, Black Swan is very much a character study and, you know, by one actress that was popular at the time. And this is very much, you know, the most popular actress at the time. And he's like, I can do this for only $30 million. It's going to be in the mode of Black Swan in terms of, you know, the, you know, limits and aesthetics. Yeah. And they're like, okay, here's the money.
It's interesting that he is, you know, through Black Swan and this, and I guess even to a small extent Noah, given that what's her name, Watson,
Emma Watson, yeah,
Emma Watson is in it. I kept wanting to call her Emily Watson. I'm like, that's not right. That he is so invested in like these like female characters and points of view. I think that's an interesting thing. Cause even the wrestler, like, you know, as much as it was about Mickey Rourke, like,
Marissa,
the woman who, Marissa Tomei and, Evan Rachel Wood.
Yes.
We're both like big characters in that. I feel like he's one of the people working today who is the most invested in like making sure that he has like an interesting female character in there. In addition to Jennifer Connelly and Noah, who I should bring up, has a lot of weight to lift, and often he puts his male characters firmly in the wrong, but not in like a Mad Men-y kind of way where it's supposed to be compelling and then slowly sublimates into something that you reject, you know, but more like they start off flawed and you know that, and you know it's not going to end well.
Mm-hmm.
So Jordan, I don't know if I'll tell you real quick. Bill and I both really loved this movie. You have a tendency to read things I read on my personal site, so I don't know if you read my review or not and have a concept of how I feel about it. But
I read a little bit of it, so
a little bit.
I want to.
So are we ready to jump into spoilers then?
Yeah. So
okay.
Yeah. So let's continue
Very
strange episode of the Film and, Stage Show,
yes,
by setting
pause.
Up spoilers. this is me, you know, padding for time for my wife,
yes.
Even though she already saw the movie, which we should talk about what her reaction to it was. But spoilers. Okay, here we are. We're in spoilers. So, I mean. This is a hard movie to talk about, because much as the movie has so much to say and goes so crazy, I feel like you could jump in at any point. I guess I want to ask each of you when it really started to turn from like a domestic drama into a very clear allegorical escalation. What was the first thing that you kind of picked up on? Like, did you immediately find it to be biblical? Did you find it to be about the gender dynamics between men and women? Because for me personally, for the longest time, I was fully invested in this movie. And Michael called this movie, I think, self-serving or egotistical. And I can see how you would think that, because for the longest time, I viewed it as sort of an allegory about what it's like being married to a creative and how, you know, if you're married to a writer or a poet or a filmmaker, you kind of have to be okay with them utilizing everything that you give them emotionally and physically in their work and letting them strip mine your life and basically rob you of agency in order to create what they are famous for creating. And so that's what I picked up on first. So I'm curious what you guys, like, kind of, what your first allegorical level reaction was.
Yeah, I have, I definitely picked up, I think, on the biblical one first. I think at first, like, the forbidden fruit with Adam and Eve with his,
yes,
the stone. And then it hit the hammer on the nail, whatever, when Cain and Abel showed up and then the brother died, and that was just, and then from there on it was just extremely obvious everything he was going for with you know, he creates quote unquote this perfect book, which is aka the Bible. Everyone populates, you know, the earth, aka the house, then a flood comes with a sink and everyone leaves, and then they come back with, you know, spreading Christianity, and then they praise him in different ways, and then a baby is born, and aka Jesus, and then his neck gets snapped like the crucifixion, and then he's consumed like, you know, communion, and then people destroy the earth, and then it gets burnt down, aka Revelations, and then
mm-hmm.
God returns.
So I have a question, Jordan. I mean, I like at a certain point I started picking up on that, and I just wanted to know, like, in that case, what do you see Jennifer Lawrence as being allegorical of? Or do you think that she represents too many things to just slap one name on it?
I think, like, Mother Earth. Like, I mean, her name's really Mother. And I think Darren Aronofsky has even... He's, like, being way too open in this press tour in terms of, like, what he thinks the movie means. I don't know if you guys have read any interviews.
Yeah,
he, like, totally denounces the creator thing, obviously, because he's the director and probably doesn't want to be equated with Javier Bardem's character. But, it's just kind of funny. Like, I've never heard a director be so open with,
he really is pushing, like, the it's about the environment type of thing.
Yeah.
I
was going to say, that's, like, the third, I think that's tied with a biblical thing, but I think that's, like, the third interpretation of the movie where, literally, if you don't even take it on a biblical level, where she's just Mother Earth and we just beat the shit out of her and
destroy her,
take her for all she's worth.
World.
And then,
yeah,
exactly. So,
Bill Graham. Mm-hmm. Which allegorical level struck you first?
I think the stone was the first indication, really, that I was in for a film that was heavily about Christianity. But I think it's interesting because I was talking with my friend Jamie as we were going back, that this film, in the way of Lawrence's having a baby and then having it kind of ripped asunder and torn apart and having this person that they created it with, I think a lot of this kind of, and this is religion in general, but this film kind of touches upon the idea of having a lifespan and how having a lifespan being created by somebody to actually have a lifespan is kind of this weird situation where we're supposed to live and die and be okay with it and be okay with the idea that someone up above created us with a limited lifespan, which is kind of like, that kind of sucks. Like, why didn't you create me to live forever? Like, why do I have a limited lifespan? And, why do I have to watch my mother and father die? Why do I have to watch my loved ones pass away? Why does that have to happen? And so I think this film kind of really, in my kind of rough interpretation of it, outside of what it kind of obviously is, I like to look into films like this that have a very obvious kind of explanation and start to kind of pull more things out from it. And I think that's kind of where I'm coming from, where, Lawrence gives birth to this creature and isn't even able to watch it live a full life. It is mm-hmm. ripped asunder before her and literally devoured.
That's the part I had the biggest laugh. I hope that doesn't say a lot about me, but
I mean, it's here's the thing. So, like, if you're able to watch this movie on, like, understanding its allegory, like, if you're able to create that distance, I think that the boldness of the images sometimes leaves you little choice but to laugh at, like, the pure audacity and, like, the pure, oh my God, they went there of it. I will mm-hmm. say that we've talked on this podcast about whether or not me becoming a father has changed me in any way. This mm-hmm. is probably the movie that tests that the most, because usually I've had the whole, like, I don't really give a shit. Like, I was empathetic enough before I became a father, and I'm good at getting critical distance, but, like, she had that baby, and I was like, if something bad happens to that fucking baby, I'm gonna lose my shit. And when its neck snaps, because this is how much of a dad I am now, I'm like, no one's supporting that baby's head.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, that's ridiculous. And I couldn't figure out if, like, the movie knew how ridiculous that was, or if this was another one of its weird dream logic things. And then its neck snapped and I felt sick to my stomach. And then they were eating it. And that's when I was like, okay, all right. I'm back on the allegorical level now because I understand what we're doing. But for a while, I was very upset. And again, like, on the verge of laughter, just because, like, it went there. Like, it definitely said, like, well, we're not going to have the baby grow up in front of her. That's too much. Let's, mm-hmm. let's kill it as a child. And that's crazy. My wife, who went and saw this movie without me, because since we have a baby, we can't go to a movie at the same time. literally threw up into her popcorn and stood up and was about to leave. But she watched the rest of the movie, like, standing in the aisle because... And then she came home and she said, it may be the best movie I've ever seen, but I think I hated it. And she she has had a very strong reaction to it. And actually, as part of the movie's power, it gave us a catalyst to talk about, like, God and religion. And she was almost certain that Darren Aronofsky was Catholic based on this film. Just because this, and coming from a Catholic man, as I am, this movie does seem like a lapsed or a former Catholic's like refutation of God's all-consuming love for humanity, because the movie seems to say, like, yeah, God loves humanity more than anything else to the detriment of everything else. Like, mm-hmm. The movie has this sense of, you know, Javier Bardem is such a nice guy. Like, he's not mean to his wife. He's not an asshole. He just wants to, like... He's not a controlling, abusive man. He has a woman who is subjugated to him in her own heart, but there never seems to be any sense of, like, he made her this way. So he is allowing her to be seen as an offshoot of him. And if he is so willing to give of himself, then she ought to be able to do the same. And obviously she does not agree, but it's this weird kind of like abuse of your partner through your love of everyone else and not understanding why they aren't just as willing to give as heavily as you are. And I think that is a very interesting viewpoint to take, and one that I haven't really seen explored a lot.
Yeah, I guess for me the movie was annoying in a sense where there's so much to be discussed, like if these were real people, where they just don't talk about anything. And so like anytime she wants to almost bring up like the situation at hand, but you know, as it escalates in their house and he just kind of brushes her to the side and ignores her, that's when the moment where I'm like, okay, I just need to disconnect that this is not any sort of reality we're living in. Like, no human being would ever talk to another human being like this or like intuit certain things that he does.
Yeah. When she berates him that, it's like, she is having a hard time dealing with this situation, and he's like, but I'm doing it for them. Like, I have to support them. And she's like, you have to support me too. Like, I live here. Like, this is a situation that is happening to me. And like, at that point, he just kind of sidetracks. And I was just like, yep, this movie is not interested in having that kind of discussion of, you know, these are humans. These are kind of, in a way, mythological creatures, you know. And it's like, we are seeing, you know, whether you talk about the gods, you know, of what, Roman mythology or whatever, you know, we can't have a conversation about, like, oh, well, they should just like go have like a mediation and like sit down with somebody. No, they're gods. They're not going to discuss things. Like,
well, and if you take that on like a literal level where they're really gods, I do find it fascinating that like the idea that the entire world happened outside of this house that we don't see.
Yeah,
like
this is Mount Olympus basically, and everything else is still happening outside.
Yeah, and I thought that was fascinating. And speaking more, I mean, we're mostly just talking about, you know, the themes and what Aronofsky is going for. But I think on a technical level, I think that kind of sequence where, you know, everything speeds up rapidly and we see, not literally, but in a timeline-wise, where we just see so much shit going down at once, I think that's kind of a testament. And we've seen since, you know, Children of Men and way beyond that, just so many, like, single shots. And I feel like this was a testament to that. You don't need to have a single take to convey a sense of claustrophobia and panic. And like when it was happening, I was like, is this a single take? And then I realized it wasn't. And I'm like, this is working a lot better because I'm not distracted that it's a single take. I'm just chaos.
I think that goes to show, you know, like I love a single take. I love a good single take. Children of Men, great. Gravity, perfect. There's a single take that I always think of in Shame too.
What'd you think about Birdman?
I'm getting to it, Bill. There are two single takes that I think about in Shame all the time. One of them is when he's in a restaurant with a woman, and you have to sit there through like their entire weird, flirty, kind of awkward opening conversation and dealing with this waiter who kind of weirdly sucks. And the other is him like running to Madison Square Garden. And like those are useful, but there has been a tendency, like in Birdman, to use a single take to give a like level of quote unquote artistry to something that very well could have operated perhaps even better without it. How much more interesting and disorienting would it have been if every time Regan Thompson like turns a corner, suddenly it's a new day or suddenly it's hours later? Like, wouldn't, like, with a hard cut, like in the Ghost story, for instance. I think that there's something to be said for that. And I think that it's almost more of a testament now to a director to be able to create a sense of flow through cuts than by just setting up a good steady cam shot and then having CGI like stitch it all together.
It's kind of funny you bring up a Ghost story, because that is going after a similar, like, showing the expansiveness of time, but in such a vastly different way.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, did you guys talk about Michelle Pfeiffer at all? Because I kind of loved her.
Mainly Michael.
That's about the only thing that we can like wrestle out of him, was he loved Michelle Pfeiffer. And apparently the first 45 minutes as well.
The first 45 minutes, but then retroactively grew to hate them because of what the movie did to them, I guess.
Yes. Yeah. I do want to mention a couple things. I mentioned it here and I didn't get much reaction out of Michael, but Brian didn't seem to indicate that this movie was very loud. Jordan, you've seen this once, right?
Yeah, and I saw it at literally Paramount, like at their screening room. So
Hold on, Brian.
Because I was saying that my friend that works at the Draft House had said that Dunkirk was obviously one of the loudest films that they've ever played. And I was suggesting that this might be more sustained, like levels of loudness in a film that I've ever seen.
This accentuates certain objects that don't need to be loud and like catches you off guard with how loud he makes them. Whereas Dunkirk, you're in war, so you can kind of expect that it's going to be loud. Whereas this movie, like every door creak, every like her doing the putty of the the wall, and like everything is just like it felt like film school 101 to me. I don't know, it just felt a little too on the nose and kind of almost distracting in a way. But but everything in this movie is engineered to be as blunt as possible. So,
Brian, you wanted to mention something?
Well, I was gonna say like maybe it's just that like. We had just seen It, which...
And those stingers.
Which, yeah, like, there's a different kind of loud. Like, I would call It aggressively loud. I would call Dunkirk and this movie, like, triumphs of sound design. Like, I didn't find the loudness of this movie to be... Well, it's definitely overwhelming, but it's not, like, oppressive. It feels calibrated and of a piece.
Yeah, I think with it was a lot to do with the overbearing score and like the telegraph score, where every scene it's like, here's what we want you to feel. Whereas this film very much kind of lets you feel a little scared and on edge at what's happening, like, you know, in the house.
I want to mention two things real quick. A, what did we make of the chimes that are like pretty much, I'm not sure when they started to happen in the film. I'm not sure
talking about like the ringing in her head.
I'm talking about the chimes that we hear towards the end of the film that then
while they close the door and you just hear like ringing every like 10 seconds.
Yes.
I think it had to do with some sort of ceremony happening outside.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
They were like preparing for crucifixion/communion.
Okay. Okay. That makes sense.
That's what I took it as. Because you don't actually see, unless I'm mistaken, you don't actually see anything
making that, that noise,
that sound. Yeah, once they go outside, because a baby has to die, so you're focused on other things.
So. The other thing I want to mention is I knew this film, and I'm sure a lot of people, you know, cued into this as well, but I knew this film was about to, like, all hell was about to break loose, more than all hell had already broken loose when Jennifer Lawrence doesn't want Javier Bardem to touch her baby, and she's just trying to stay awake, and you just keep focusing back on Bardem's just like slowly scooting that chair up and then sitting in front of her and just having this blank stare at her for, I don't know, that sequence goes on for like a good 3-4 minutes, and I was just like, oh shit, this is like, I can understand why that would be the moment when people start to get up out of their seat and like, I can't stand this, I can't take this, I can't take this, and then like get up out of their seat because they know that nothing good is going to happen with that single-minded, like, demented stare that that Bardem gives. It's like, nothing good is going to happen to this baby.
No, absolutely not. And it's, I mean, it's such a... It's such a hard thing to have to endure, to like know what's going to happen. But I mean, like, that's just how it is, I guess. Like, that's how it's got to be in the movie.
Now that we're kind of like deep into spoiler territory, this movie had a lot of like red herrings, I would say, that I don't know, I felt completely fulfilled by, like, the yellow powder that she uses in certain things. Did anyone pick up on what that was?
It was, if you notice, every time she dips it into the water, they show kind of a look back of the glass, and you can see the orange red kind of tendrils inside of the water, just like you see inside of the stone itself that he has on that pedestal. And so
there's a definite luminescence.
Yeah, and for me, that's kind of what was happening every single time was and if you look at a poster of this film, you can actually see Lawrence in one of the posters, like, literally ripping something out of her chest. It's basically that stone again, and it's just like, whoa, shit,
in the poster,
okay.
It's her heart, so yeah.
Yes, but yeah. Well, but I mean, her heart is the stone, right?
Yes.
So someone mentioned the yellow powder could be turmeric, which is, I guess, like a natural painkiller, and also in Latin means like deserving earth, is what I saw online. So I don't know what, like, if, because it is interesting that Michelle Pfeiffer's character asks her if she has painkillers, and she lies. So I don't know if there's something to be read deeper into that.
For me,
it could have been purely allegorical. Like, it could just be, this is some sort of salve that helps her to repress and take away the pain of her subjugation, and it just like makes this go away, because it seemed that often it was like stress and anxiety that made her have to take it, then when she becomes pregnant, she pours it away, because you got to be careful what you're putting in your body when you're pregnant. That's not special knowledge. That's just common sense. And then she has the baby. And so she doesn't have that to calm her. And now that timidity has been replaced by, you could call it, like, you know, instinctual maternal love. Whatever makes her pick up that piece of glass and start killing people, that is what has replaced that yellow powder. So the physical truth of what the yellow powder is, to me, is less important than what it means that she stops taking it and what is replaced by it. I've been like working on trying to write something meaningful about Mother beyond just my review. And I think that I've actually started like a one-man campaign against like explainer culture, or like figuring things out, like the type of thing that ruined Westworld like 2 episodes in, and the type of thing that leads people to write like 4,000 words on the fact that Bran looks like the Night King in Game of Thrones. Like, I feel like there's a difference between trying to understand a reference that you didn't get and trying to fit everything together like a puzzle. Because there's a certain point at which if you're able to understand the intention behind something, then the factual, like, objective truth of what it was maybe is less interesting. Like, maybe there is nothing that powder was supposed to be. And, you know, but we're finding things like, well, what's yellow? What's something that has a meaning that could be interesting? Okay, that's it.
Yeah, there's a reason why David Lynch and Terrence Malick don't, like, do interviews and break down their films.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, it's just funny because, like, you can go online and find things that say, like, the ending of Mother Explained. And I haven't read any of them because I don't want to, because even if the article then goes on to say, like, what are you fucking crazy? Like, there's like seven different things this could mean. No one can tell you objectively what it means. Not even the director, despite what he thinks. Like, I just don't want to click on that. And I don't want to keep that culture going, because things like this right now are like what this movie should be doing. Like, should be saying. That's why I didn't ask anyone.
What do you mean? What do you mean?
Like,
what's going
things
on?
Like us
right
talking,
now?
Like us working our way through how we felt and what we believe is more what this movie should be spurring on than, you know,
it's not like a puzzle that you're trying to figure out all the pieces.
Right.
For.
Well, it's not J.J. Abrams. It's not even Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, where it's just confusing enough, or God, Atomic Blonde, where it's confusing enough that you may need someone to explain the objective facts.
Sure.
Like, I can explain the objective facts to you, but you really ought to take this movie into your soul and into your heart and into your brain and just fucking knock it around a bit and then see what it turns into for you.
Well, but, okay, two things. Yes. A, some people... It's unfortunate because a lot of people, they like to discuss movies, but they don't have anybody to discuss movies in any kind of depth and detail with, which is why online has kind of spurred on this culture of, like, talking about it. And the comment section is rife with a lot of that stuff. Rarely do articles really kind of encourage that kind of conversation, because it's hard to have a conversation in an article. I've seen pieces where they are smart enough to realize, hey, let's have a conversation between two or three writers and kind of put that online. And I really like those articles, especially when they deal with one subject matter.
I mean, that's pretty much what we're doing.
Yes, but...
I'll transcribe this, guys. And we'll just
okay, perfect.
Yes, there we go. But you're saying, basically, Brian, to keep this inside your heart and then like, form some opinions on it. But I saw this yesterday, mm-hmm. so I don't have that opportunity. And so having this discussion with y'all is kind of helping me formulate my own opinions and thoughts about
right,
it.
Right, but I think, Bill, that you misinterpreted. I don't want you to be monk-like in silence about this movie. I think that having a responsive conversation with another person is exactly what you should be doing. But, like, an explainer article is not a responsive conversation. It is... Google what does the ending of blank mean, you were looking for someone to tell you that. And so I think that this is a type of movie you need to block out an hour afterwards. You need to go to a coffee shop or a bar, depending on the type of person you are. And you need to, like, fucking talk it out. That's why I openly encouraged my wife to go see this on Thursday, like at 7 p.m., like opening day, like what they call the preview day now. Because I was like, I need to talk about this movie with someone. I don't even know if I can write a review for this without being able to talk to someone about it first.
There's actually one aspect I would actually be quite interested to see or to hear what your wife had to say, or any other female for that matter. But I think one thing that this movie does really in an interesting way, where I saw some reviews initially call, you know, Darren Aronofsky the ultimate misogynist and stuff, but I think those are kind of misconstruing the film as, you know, reputation being like an endorsement, you know, almost like Wolf of Wall Street or something like that. Where,
0 to 30.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas I think this film actually takes, you know, I mean, if you read the Bible, it is very much, you know, a male perspective, obviously. And this kind of movie, I think, shows what that other side feels like throughout all of history, like, you know, up to its ultimate, you know, endpoint, which is kind of horrifying. You know, if you just look at the, you know, the movie, the entire movie's lens is viewed through Jennifer Lawrence, pretty much. And I think it's kind of interesting where he just is trying to provide this other perspective of, you know, of centuries and centuries worth of history. And I feel like it's not just the Christian religion either.
No.
So,
I mean,
I don't know if what you guys thought about that, of, you know, flipping it on its head in that kind of way.
I mean, I don't, I don't even know how to, like, respond to anyone who looks at this movie and calls it misogynistic, because there's nothing in the movie that would, that, that seems to endorse what's happening to this woman. Like, this isn't The Wedding Crashers or something. Like, this is a movie that is very clearly on her side and is, you know, allegorically expressing some historical truths. Like, I'm sorry that the world sucked for a long time and remains a shitty place for a lot of people, but there's a balance between showing what has happened as a means of, like, there are people who venerate the past, the same people who, like, you know, wish that we could all go back to Mad Men because they believe they'd be the guy with the fedora sitting in the big office, and they don't think they're going to be Hollis pressing a button in the elevator. Or any of the other people who had to suffer. They don't think they're going to be Betty being told that her very real and legitimate concerns are a kind of hysterical madness. Like, those people would venerate the past, and this movie is very clearly not on the side of that.
Sure. A lot of those people are also more than likely white males.
Well, yes, that was implied by my statement. But, I mean, yeah, there are people who aren't white males who still are like, oh, man, I wish I could live back then, because they just kind of... The glamour of it, and it was a glamorous time in that specific place, but, like, the glamour of it, like, clouds your mind, and you're like, but that's not what it would have been like for you. Even if you are a white male, you still would have gotten stepped on by all the other white males who had the good fortune to be born in a better position or as a better liar than you.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, like, it's like if people were to call Mad Men misogynistic. It wasn't. It was a very clear-eyed representation of the way that things used to be. And you can't blame people for reacting positive, or you can't blame the show for people reacting positively to that. What this movie has in its favor is, I highly doubt that anyone is going to come out thinking that Javier Bardem is the good guy. I don't know that he is. He's not a classical villain. He's not like his own character, Silva, from Skyfall. I think that there's a strange level of villainy to his like open love for the world. And in all the time that my wife and I have spent talking about this, she has never once said that Darren Aronofsky was a misogynist. And I could like go and get her and bring her in and ask her, but I mean, maybe I'll record a separate interview with her and post it at the end.
Yeah. That's what this podcast needs. Three separate parts. Just like, well, yeah, I just found it interesting, like, you know, Mother, aka Jennifer Lawrence, she, you know, she does all the work, you know, she creates everything, like, he's, you know, has this writer's block, aka can't do anything, and, you know, everything that's, you know, the entire house, she did all the work for, he didn't help at all, and then, like, when it's time for, like, the funeral table, or, like, the, you know, the funeral party, no one's listening to her, and, you know, she isn't, you know, acknowledged or thanked at all, and, you know, the people who come to the house don't even, you know, pay any attention to her. And she just is kind of, you know, literally the house is exploding around her. And like, she just doesn't get any recognition. So I just thought that was an interesting, you know, look at, Christianity.
My friend Jamie noted one thing, while like there's soldiers like running in, one of the soldiers, like, he presses his hand up against Lawrence's belly and then also like examines her teeth. And my friend Jamie said that in that specific scene, one of the other soldiers calls him Archangel. And I was like, holy shit, I need to watch this movie like 20 more times to like slow down everything, turn down everything. I want to watch this movie with subtitles.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, this movie definitely needs some subtitles.
My wife, one of the things that my wife brought up is the fact that one of the few people who, like, really, really singles out Mother and tries to help her is a woman of color who appears to, like, be clothed in, like, vaguely pagan garb.
Mm-hmm.
My wife is attuned to this because while she is not a pagan, her religion draws from aspects of paganism. And she said that that was, like, a powerful statement, given that you then have all these other people tearing the world apart. And then I pointed out to her that one of the other people, like, one of maybe these might be the only two people in the movie who really seem to care about her, is one of the soldiers.
Yes.
Who puts her out of harm's way and then is shot in the face. It's this weird kind of dynamic where, depending on what you think about what's happening there, you've got, like, yeah, sure, like, people of all kinds are, like, attuned to helping her, either for duty and honor or because of, like, honest love and care. But those people are almost always shunted away because the tide of people who don't give a damn are always going to be louder and more violent. And and we also have Kristen Wiig dual-wielding guns and killing people as she walks through a room.
That is one of those moments where I was like, this is either the worst or best film I've ever seen.
Yes, that was so insane.
I was a little shocked, and it was awesome.
I don't know if you guys ever have, like, nightmares where you just feel like no one can hear you and you're, like, screaming and want to wake up. Like,
oh,
this
God,
movie
constantly.
Captures that feeling really well.
This movie, everyone that I know has had that dream where, like, there's something wrong with your house or where you're living and it is escalating out of control and you cannot make it stop. And as much as I had a visceral, like, reaction to watching that baby die, I think the part of the movie that infuriated me the most and, like, got me the most agitated was when the people were bouncing on her sink. And, like,
yeah.
I don't know what it was about that, but the fact that she just kept politely saying, like, don't sit on the sink, like, it's not braced, and these people who she just told that to then sat down and started bouncing on it and said, see, it's fine. Like, I just, and then they were so angry at her for making her leave. And I've had so many dreams where I'm in the right and people are, like, angry at me for it, for asking for very reasonable things. Like, this movie, like, is an empathy engine that is run on my nightmares.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what I enjoy about this film so much, is you can take away so many different allegories out of it and still enjoy this film as just, like, nightmare, just absolute raw and utter nightmare. And you don't have to take the religious tones, and you don't have to take celebrity culture, and you don't have to take all of these other things that you can layer on top of it. And you can just say, what a fucking thrilling movie that for 2 hours was just, like, relentless. Like just read it on a surface level in that way. And I think people get so wrapped up in what the interpretation has to be that I feel like they're like, oh, it's good or bad based on that. It's like, no, what about just, like, a raw nerve experience that this film really kind of, like, goes for? And I think in that way, it's an utter success, regardless of whether you dismiss the allegories wholly or not, or you like the way that the film kind of ends, which, of course, you know, like, maybe they didn't have to have Jennifer Lawrence at the end. Maybe they could have had somebody else. The weird CG nose was a little much for me. I was like, oh, okay, I guess that's what they're going for.
Someone made the point that the first woman looks like Rachel Weisz, which is very interesting. The very first shot of the film,
Someone asked, I think it was Dave Chen from the Slash film cast, asked if Rachel Weisz was in the film.
No, and, you only see, there's three women, so it's just the first burnt woman, then Jennifer Lawrence, and a completely different woman at the end of the bed.
Well, I was going to say someone else responded to him by saying something like, she might as well have been.
is that a completely different woman at the end?
Oh, yes.
Oh,
for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bill.
Yeah.
That was such a different woman. You know who she looked like? She looked like Michelle Trachtenberg.
Okay, so it's not just Lawrence with like a prosthetic nose.
No.
No.
Oh. Yeah. For their, whatever their reason, I thought it was. I did find it weird that I'm not sure if this was a personal choice by Lawrence or whether this was supposed to kind of age her up, because they obviously talk about like a huge generational gap between Bardem and her character throughout the film. But what was the decision behind the hair color? It's got like that old dirty gray kind of look to it. And
she's
got
like an ashy dishwater blonde kind of thing going on.
It's the earth. It's been weathered. People have trampled on it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or the lighting was just off in that scene. I don't know. But yeah.
Well, that's the route. Like, I was just like, Jesus, her hair
is dirty.
You
know that gray silver hair is like the new it color for young women?
Yes.
It's right up there with mermaid hair.
You joke like there actually is that trend right now.
Oh, no. I'm joking about the trend. I am aware of the trend. I have many female friends on Facebook who post videos. Anyway, we have talked quite a bit about this movie. I'm sure that we could talk quite a bit more, but we should be off. Jordan, you swooped in like Superman to take Mike's place, and I think this spoiler discussion has been super great, and thank you for being so flexible.
Absolutely. Any other time I hate a movie, then kind of like it again, and then someone else hates it and still hates it, let me know.
All right. Awesome. It's a very specific set of circumstances, but one that I'm sure we'll probably come up against again. That's it for today, ladies and gentlemen. If you have thoughts on Mother, please reach out. Twitter at Film Stage Show, our website, where you can comment on these, thefilmstage.com. And
Did you announce a giveaway, Brian?
Yes, I did.
Oh, good job. Good job.
Yeah, I did that up front. thanks for keeping me honest. What was else I going to say? Podcast at thefilmstage.com. You can email us. And if you're a Patreon giver, I guess, then you can talk to us in our Slack channel. And I definitely want to hear from people who loved this movie, from people who hated this movie, as long as they actually have something to say. And can put it out there. And again, our thoughts and our prayers are with Michael. May he have a speedy recovery from the movie Mother. We are brought to you by MUBI. All you have to do is go to MUBI.com/filmstage for a free 30-day trial of one of the coolest movie streaming sites on the interwebs. Every day they introduce a new film that you have 30 days to watch, so you have a constantly rotating selection of 30 films. It is a perfectly curated selection that is ever evolving, so that there is always something interesting to watch. And if you find yourself one day saying, oh my god, I've seen everything, and the one thing I haven't seen I'm not interested in, all you gotta do is wait a day. It's pretty great. Remember, you can download movies to watch on the go, and Brian Rowan gives MUBI their best video streaming app stamp of approval, because truly it is the only video streaming app that has anything like a decent user interface. So again, that's MUBI.com/filmstage.
I'd also recommend By the Time It Gets Dark, which is an underseen 2007 film that they just added. So go watch that.
Yeah, get your free trial, and you can watch that right now. Patreon.com/thefilmstageshow to help us continue to create this great content, and to I was going to say, to be entered into raffles for cool movie stuff. This week, we're giving away a DVD of Beatrice at Dinner, so check it out. And remember, ladies and gentlemen, if you are giving to our Patreon, if you would like Beatrice at Dinner specifically, shout us out, and we will put your name in the hat twice so that we can make sure that the people who really want these things have a better chance of getting them, and the people who don't still have a chance, but not as high. So... that is it for today. Next week, we may be talking about Kingsman, The Golden Circle. Maybe.
Shoot me in the face.
All right. Well, we're going to have Jordan back.
No.
We may be talking about something on indie screens or VOD as well, if we see the movie and just think that there's not enough to talk about. But I loved the first Kingsman, and I'm vaguely excited for this one. So who knows? Maybe we'll talk about a wide release thing. Oh, well, that's not quite true. We talked about it the other day. Anyway. And this was a wide release. Still astounding to me that this is a wide release.
Yeah.
I guess it's like crazy. I'm just used to people yelling at us for not talking about popular movies.
You guys are so populous with talking about Mother.
I know. I mean, this movie was released in over 2,000 screens. We've really sold out. Anyway, Michael Snydell can be found at Snydell. And, of course, he writes for the Film Stage.
Send him some encouragement.
Yeah, let's send him some love. Send him cute gifts of otters or kittens or capybara. Anyway, Jordan Rapp, why don't you tell the people at home where you can be found between now and whenever you once again appear on our airwaves.
Yeah, I'm at JP Rapp on Twitter and on the Film Stage. And I'm also working at Film Society of Lincoln Center with New York Film Festival kicking off in under 2 weeks. So if any of our listeners are attending New York Film Festival, you will certainly see me around because I will be working 24/7 for 18 days straight. So
fantastic.
It's going to be fun.
All right. Bill Graham, what about yourself?
You can follow me on Twitter at CableBFG. You can also find me on the Slack channel having a blast and talking more about my giggles.
And you can find me on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan. You can find me on my personal site, dearfilm.net, where I have a review of Mother up right now, as though you want to hear me talk about it more. I'm writing an article about Mother. I don't know if Jordan's going to want to publish it or if it's going to be on my personal site or if I just delete the whole fucking thing because I just can't handle it. But, hey, follow me on Twitter and you'll know if it ever gets published. In addition, thefilmstage.com. And, that is all. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us and tune in next week.
Your love, I wake up in